From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen continues its Year of Darwin celebration with an interview with Dr. Stephen Barker from the University of Queensland in Australia about how the mitochondrial DNAs of human body lice are providing the pieces to a new genomic puzzle.
Dr. Stephen Barker is an associate professor and reader in the School of Chemistry and Molecular Bioscience at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia. He is an expert on the genetics and evolution of lice and ticks. Dr. Barker, thanks for talking to us today and taking part in Gen's monthly celebration of the Year of Darwin. I'd like you to begin by discussing the impact of Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution on science in general. And secondly, how has the Darwinian evolutionary paradigm influenced your own research studies?
Yes, well, the idea that life on Earth is old and that life has changed a lot, that is, that life has evolved, is the paradigm within which I work. This paradigm seems to have generated a lot of new knowledge, which is very exciting. The paradigm seems to work. Darwin's theory, it's unified biology. We now have much evidence that all animals, all plants, and all bacteria adapt to their worlds. They evolve. So botanists, farmers, microbiologists, biotechnologists, we're all unified. We all work on species that have an extraordinarily long history and which have changed to meet the challenges of their worlds. A biologist who ignores this history, in my view, and the consequences of this history, does so at their peril. In the words of a very famous geneticist, Theodore Dobzhansky, Theodore noted that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And that's certainly been the experience of my career as a scientist.
The study your group, in conjunction with the J. Craig Venter Institute, recently reported on in genome research, involved human body lice. Before we talk about the results of your study, would you explain why lice should be viewed as more than just a familiar nuisance?
Yeah, well, body lice transmit three pathogens, and these pathogens have killed hundreds of millions of people. For example, louse-borne epidemic typhus killed over 50 million people during and immediately after World War I. Now, head lice don't kill people, but they are the most common infectious agent in elementary schools after the common cold. These head lice, they bite and they suck blood. Their bites are painful to children. Head lice may be a nuisance to parents and to schools, but they're absolutely hated by children. These head lice inject anticoagulants and antihistamines and other drugs into their hosts when they're feeding, and these make children and people feel unwell. Often children can't sleep, and they certainly can't concentrate well in class when they're infected with head lice.
In your journal paper, the research team analyzed the mitochondrial genome of the human body louse. What did you discover, and why was this considered remarkable?
We discovered that the body louse has 18 chromosomes in its mitochondria. All other animals on Earth have one chromosome.
Two questions immediately arise as a result of your finding that the human body louse has a mitochondrial chromosome that is fragmented into 18 mini-chromosomes. Any idea on how this fragmented mitochondrial DNA structure evolved, and what advantages might it confer on the louse?
Well, first, the question, how did this fragmented mitochondrial genome structure evolve? We describe in our paper how we think that one large chromosome can evolve into 18 mini-chromosomes. And it seems that the multiple mini-chromosomes were generated from a series of events that involved the excision and then the rejoining of fragments of mitochondrial chromosomes over a very long period of time. In each event, a fragment that contained the non-coding region, which we also call the control region because it has sequence elements that are critical for replication and transcription of these chromosomes, One or a few genes near this non-coding region have been excised from a typical chromosome. Now, the two ends of these fragments apparently join together to form a new functional mini-chromosome. So long as this new mini-chromosome has the control region, it will function normally. In fact, if this new mini-chromosome has a selective advantage over the typical chromosome, then the genes on the mini-chromosome will eventually take over the function of their counterparts on the typical large chromosome. And thus, eventually, their counterparts on the typical chromosome become redundant. So then you get deletion of these redundant genes from the typical chromosome. It's getting smaller. And this moves other genes closer to the control region, the non-coding region. The next event of excision and rejoining would generate another new mini-circular chromosome. And eventually, all of the genes on a typical mitochondrial chromosome would be on mini-chromosomes, and the big chromosome has shrunk down to nothing. This is a simple yet elegant way that a large chromosome with 37 genes could evolve into 18 mini-chromosomes that each have 1 to 3 genes, but 37 genes in total in the whole cell. The second part of your question was what advantages might mini-chromosomes confer to these insects. Well, we speculate that having many mini-chromosomes rather than one large chromosome is an advantage to the mitochondrial genome replication and mitochondrial genome transcription, gene transcription, because each chromosome has only about a fifth of the, is about a fifth of the size of a typical mitochondrial chromosome, and thus we expect it would replicate much faster than a typical chromosome. Further, several mini-chromosomes may be replicated simultaneously, so the whole thing could be much faster. Similarly, genes in mini-chromosomes may be transcribed more efficiently than genes on a typical chromosome. In a typical chromosome, many genes on a strand, maybe 20 genes, have to be transcribed in one go. And whereas in mini-chromosomes, it may be possible to transcribe just one or two genes at once, and so have a lot more flexibility and a lot more control of the gene expression and replication of these chromosomes, these genes.
We'll talk a little bit more about gene expression and replication a little later. How did you go about sequencing this mitochondrial genome, and what types of instrumentation did you use?
Well, we've been trying to amplify by PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, the mitochondrial genome of the body louse for about 8 years, but we just couldn't get our PCRs to work. We now know that this was because we designed our PCR experiments to amplify one large chromosome. But of course, this chromosome doesn't exist in these insects. Rather, there are 18 mini-chromosomes. Now, once we knew that there were mini-chromosomes, then it was quite easy to amplify these with PCR. We got a clue that this insect had mini-chromosomes rather than a regular chromosome from the DNA sequences from the Body Louse Genome Project. This project was critical to our discovery. Once we had that information and we knew what to look for, then we used PCR, DNA sequencing, and gel electrophoresis, fairly standard techniques, to discover exactly how many mini-chromosomes there were and exactly the genes that these contained.
In addition to your study, what other kinds of sequencing research has been done in body lice by other groups?
Yeah, we're members of a large consortium of scientists from all around the world, the Body Louse Genome Consortium, and there are many scientists here working on all lots of different aspects of the genomes of these insects. And most of this work is finished, and a paper on the genome of the body louse and the genes and the biochemistry of the body louse should be out soon.
With the louse genetic code mapped, how might this information be used to develop new strategies for treatment and prevention of infestation?
Well, we now have plenty of genetic markers to study the transmission of head lice from one child to another and body lice from one person to another. The transmission of these lice from one family to another, and indeed transmission of lice from one school to another. So that will be very interesting. We actually know very little about the mechanics of transmission, how these things get around. They're incredibly infectious. We don't know we don't understand that very well. We also hope that we might find new targets for insecticides against lice in the genome of these things.
Let's get back to some issues related to evolutionary theory. Dr. David Rand of Brown University, a mitochondrial DNA evolution expert, said your team's discovery raises some new and interesting questions. Let's explore two of them. One, why is the fragmented mitochondrial DNA structure restricted to this lineage? And two, why don't we see transitional stages of this organization in related lice?
With regard to the first question, why is the fragmented mitochondrial DNA structure restricted to this lineage? We know that all of the lice that infect humans and all of the lice that infect other primates, that's three families of lice, all of these have mini chromosomes in their mitochondria that have fragmented into these mini fragmented from the large chromosome. They don't have the typical large chromosome. We predict that many other lineages of animals actually have mini chromosomes too. Now that we know mini chromosomes are a possibility, we didn't know that before, but now that we know that they are, people, we and others, we hope, can design PCR experiments to look for mini chromosomes. When scientists have trouble amplifying by PCR the mitochondrial genome of their species of animal, we suggest they try amplifying a mini chromosome. They may be surprised to discover that they have mini chromosomes in their creatures. We expect that mini chromosomes have evolved many times in nature. Parallel evolution and convergent evolution are real themes in nature. And it'll be exciting to discover which other lineages of animals have these extraordinary mitochondrial chromosomes. With regard to your second question, why don't we see transitional stages of this organism in related lice? Well, either we haven't looked hard enough yet, or the mitochondrial chromosomes of lice fragmented long ago, and thus there aren't any transitional stages left to find. I suspect that the second possibility is correct, at least for the primate lice, that the transition from one large mitochondrial chromosome to 18 mini chromosomes happened in lice many years ago, probably well over 20 million years ago in the common ancestor of these lice. And there haven't been any large chromosomes left for many, many millions of years for us to, they're just not there anymore. They've gone. And once they're gone, it's hard to imagine how they might come back in a lineage, although that's possible.
Picking up on a point you made earlier, Dr. Rand also asked whether fragmented mini chromosomes have implications for gene regulation. How do you respond to his question? Does this organization provide an advantage for more control over individual gene expression in mitochondrial genomes?
Yeah, in theory at least, having mitochondrial genes in mini chromosomes does give more control over gene expression. In most large mitochondrial chromosomes, there are two long transcripts, one in each direction, whereas in the lice, there are 18 short transcripts. So there's a much more flexibility there, in theory at least. We don't know, but it may be that this gives mini chromosomes an advantage over the large chromosomes, and that this explains why mini chromosomes have replaced large chromosomes, the typical chromosome, in the three families of lice that we've studied that infect humans and other primates. Once we find these mini chromosomes in other lineages and see whether or not they have replaced completely the large chromosomes, this will help us to understand a bit more about why the transitional stages aren't there. There must have been transitional stages at some point, but at least in the insects we've studied, we think that they have disappeared over 20 million years ago.
Picking up on your research report in genome research, where do you and your team go from here?
Yeah, well, this has opened up a whole new area, really. We're interested in several questions relating to mitochondrial mini chromosomes. We really want to know how these mini chromosomes are segregated when mitochondria replicate, and so how these 18 mini chromosomes are passed to the daughter mitochondria and so the daughter cells. This is possibly more complicated than passing one chromosome from a mitochondria to daughter chromosomes. We want to know how these are replicated and how they're transcribed and whether they can recombine with one another, that is, join with one another to make new combinations of genes. These are the things that we're really interested in at the moment.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.